Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are. My name is Edwin Kelly. This is the Dharma Geek session for the 6th of February in the United States. It's already the 7th of February where I am, Friday lunchtime. Thank you very much for joining us. You're most welcome to be here. So let's just begin, shall we, with a moment or two of practice, a minute or two, just settling into finding your posture with your body upright, but your mind at ease and your body at ease. And connecting to whatever experience is occurring in this present moment, wherever your attention lands. Just allowing your awareness to rest with your experience. With an open heart, an open mind. Letting go of chasing after something or pushing anything away. And turning our mind to our intention, our motivation. As Mingyur Rinpoche says, in the nectar of the path, in order to bring all beings to the state of omniscient Buddhahood, I will now practice the path. And so here we are, engaging in some exploration, discussion of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, the path, and specifically how it applies to our practice. May this be a benefit to all beings. Well, thank you. Yeah. So I spent a bit of time this morning putting together a bunch of notes. And I just want to acknowledge you, it's now 2 or 3 weeks since we've had access to Module 3 in the immersion course. And the Module 3 focuses specifically on shamatha or calm abiding meditation. And in the first session, Mingyur Rinpoche's video gives a very broad outline or an overview of the path that leads to liberation. I thought that video was actually filled with some wonderful things. I'm always amazed at Mingyur Rinpoche's ability to, and a number of times I've had been in teachings from him where he kind of zooms out and gives you a 30,000 feet, a 10,000 meter view of the path. And as a practitioner, that can be really helpful. And so he talks about how, the path systematically, the practice of shamatha and vipassana is the path. And module three begins with shamatha practice. And this, some of you I know attended this first sessions yesterday with either Kunsung or I in this four-part program where we're focusing very specifically on the practices that are in this module, this third module, shamatha practices. And I think the end of next week, the next module, module four, will be released. I think from now on, the 15th of each month, the next modules will be released. And so beginning with the fourth module, we will begin to explore the Vipassana teachings. And the second four-part series that is next month in March, that Kunsung and I will each be doing a session for 4 weeks, will focus exclusively on the shamatha aspect of it. So right now we're very much in the midst of the shamatha practice. Excuse me. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about shamatha and vipassana and why these practices are laid out in the way that they are. And so in order to explain that adequately, we first should revisit what the problem is and why it's necessary to do these practices. And of course, that takes us back to the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, which basically says at its core, our experience, our psychophysical experience, this mind and body that we live in and all that it entails, that at its core is unsatisfactory. It does not essentially provide fulfillment. There's a lot of wonderful things, but regardless of what we pursue, what we do, what we accumulate, what relationships we have, it's not at its core satisfactory. And no matter how much we do to make it better, it's still not quite right. We can't control a lot of our external influences, the actions of others, even our environment. And many things seem to be constantly attempting to undermine our well-being and cause us harm and distress. Between the first noble truth and the law of entropy, if you understand science, it's kind of like we're doomed in some way. They're both working very much against us. So the first module, or first session in this module three, the topic is the method of engaging in practice. And in that, Rinpoche says, so in his video, so how do these two alleviate or uproot suffering? And these two being shamatha and vipassana. And he says, remember that the cause of suffering is kleshas or karmic imprints. These two things need to be purified. They need to be slowly eliminated. So how do we slowly eliminate these kleshas? How do we purify or eliminate these karmic imprints? And so to help us understand that, we need to turn our attention to the cause of suffering, the second noble truth. And in essence, the second noble truth says that the cause of suffering is the mind that clings or grasps. And what does it mean by that? We are grasping or clinging because we're confused or deluded. The understanding of the nature of our psychophysical experience, the underlying cause is delusion or ignorance. And due to our confusion, we perceive our experience as being made up of a subject, self, and objects, everything else. And due to our confusion, this subject and object is separated or are separate or distinct. We are separate and distinct from the objects of our experience. And in fact, this is not the truth of our reality. That understanding or that perception doesn't align with the ultimate truth. This is the root cause of our confusion and delusion. We've bifurcated. I've talked about this a number of times. We've split subject and object and self and other. And when this happens, it gives rise to, that's what causes or gives rise to our kleshas, particularly the kleshas of greed and hatred or lust, desire, sensuality, and aversion, hatred, anger. Those two, chasing after stuff, pushing stuff away. There's so many things that we like that we don't have, and there's so many things we don't like that we want to get rid of. So this is essentially the kleshas, the karmic imprints or patterns that Rinpoche is referring to, the underlying cause of our malcontent. It's a great word, isn't it? Malcontent. It's a great actual translation for dukkha. I think it's even better than suffering, malcontent. So you might ask then, how does the shamatha and vipassana work, or why are these practices the way to purify and eliminate these kleshas or karmic imprints? So let's begin, because this is where we are, and I'll say a little bit about vipassana, but most of what I'm going to talk about is shamatha, because as I said, next month that we begin vipassana, and I want to save some of my thunder for a future Dharma geek. So let's start by looking at how shamatha works. And the techniques that are employed that come to us from this tradition have been so skillfully articulated by Mingo Rinpoche in this amazing compendium that he crafted during COVID called Stainless Prajna or Stainless Wisdom. And in that he says the way to eliminate these kleshas and karmic imprints is by practicing breathing meditation. And that's what Kunsung and I have been doing, or doing, focusing on in this 4-week workshops we're doing. And that begins by just simply counting the breath. And as we did yesterday, if you were part of those sessions, not only did we count the breath, but we began to follow the breath in and out. And next week we'll look at settling, first settling on the breath so that it becomes a whole body experience, and then investigating the nature of our breath. So what is happening as we do this, we are slowly, slowly, moment by moment, reprogramming our mind not to chase after what we like and push away what we don't like, but rather return to the present moment of being aware of our breath. We are replacing our karmic imprint of being distracted by some bright and shiny object with the imprint to remain connected to our present moment experience. So that's how shamatha works. Right, we've given up this karmic imprint to run after or push away or get into this tug of war with our experience. We've replaced that with connecting, recognizing, awareness, applying awareness to our present moment experience, and in this case specifically the breath. And the beauty of using the breath is, and this is if you've practiced in other Buddhist traditions or have some understanding of other traditions, you'll probably realize that most meditation traditions, Buddhist traditions, will begin with the breath. The techniques might vary, may not be exactly the same or similar to what you find in this stainless prajna, but nonetheless, most techniques will begin with the breath. And the reason why we begin there is that it's a crucial function of our body. It's always present. If we're not breathing, we're dead. So the fact that we're alive, we breathe. So here is this immediate experience that is always present, that we can immediately turn to, bring our attention to, as an antidote for this kalesha of getting our kaleshas of being caught up in our experience. And it's not just present in time, it's present in place, right? The breath is in our body, it's connected to our body. So it's not something that happened yesterday or something that's happening tomorrow that we experience, and it's not something that's happening somewhere else that we need to imagine or whatever. It is happening in our body, in this moment, here and now. So by connecting, bringing awareness to the breath, to physical moment, to present moment experience, we are here now. Here physically, now in terms of time. And it's important to understand your words. It's helpful to understand, to see how that works, if that makes sense. So the breath's a powerful place to start to retrain our mind not to be distracted. But I probably don't need to tell you, even though this sounds easy, it's not necessarily so, right? Our habits, our karmic imprints to chase after things or push things away are very, very deeply ingrained. And so this will take some time. It'll take time to reprogram our habit. So for this reason, we need to continue to deepen the connection of our awareness to our experience. And that's why the first four meditation techniques slowly, slowly progress from just counting to following to settling, etc. Each one of these meditation practices that are in module four kind of take us deeper, step by step, closer and closer, a deeper connection to our present moment experience. And as we do this, we will find that our mind will act out in perplexing ways. Because our karmic imprints are strong. The understanding in this tradition is that we have been in samsara since beginningless time. I have mentioned this a number of times. That's quite a while. We didn't just get here yesterday or last week or even this life, according to this understanding of cyclic existence. And, you know, we talk about innumerable lifetimes. So these patterns that we have, our kaleshas, our karmic imprints, have been deeply, deeply, deeply ingrained in our behavior. And so changing them is not going to come quick and easy. And because the habits are so strong, we're likely to encounter some resistance to bringing the mind back to the present moment. I had a lot of practice chasing after things and running away from displeasure. So when we train our mind to be present, our mind will find many ways to rebel. And particularly this tradition, these teachings, talk about five hindrances or five specific ways in which our mind will act out. And Rinpoche alludes, I don't know whether he's actually touched on this up to where we are. I think he has. Yeah. And so those five hindrances are the mind will crave pleasure, chocolate, wine, sex, movies, drugs. When we sit there on the cushion and we keep bringing our mind back to this present moment, all of a sudden, ooh, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Right? So that's the first hindrance. And the second one is, and this gets really petty, we become annoyed at the smallest inconvenience. Aversion, hatred, like, oh my God, it could be some stupid little thing, really. How soft our cushion is, or all that noise that that insect's making, or the dripping tap, or whatever. It doesn't really take much. It's like our mind becomes hypersensitive to what things that we dislike, the aversion. So that's the second hindrance, is aversion, ill will. And the third one is that our mind will get agitated or restless. We'll find ourselves climbing the walls. Like, I gotta get out of here. This is driving me nuts. I can't stand this. That's kind of like what happens. We think we're going crazy. So restlessness and remorse is the third. And then the fourth is we'll get sleepy, like sluggish, like all of a sudden, oh God, I did sleep for eternity. We just want to crawl into a cave and never come out. Yeah, anything to get away from this present moment. Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? So sleepiness or torpor. Sloth and torpor, it's sometimes translated as. And then the final hindrance is doubt. Geez, I'm no good at this. Well, this doesn't make sense. This is nuts. Why am I doing this? This cannot be the way to get enlightened. Right? And I'm no good. God. Somebody else could probably do this, but me, I'm hopeless. This is not for me. Doubt. So, sense pleasure, ill will, restlessness and remorse, sloth and torpor, and doubt are the five hindrances. And so, really, what's going on here, we're training our mind to not engage in its habituated patterns, and what happens when we do this, our mind will act out because the patterns are so deeply ingrained. We will rebel. The mind will rebel. I don't like doing what you want me to do. Stop it. The beautiful thing I loved about the way Mingo Rinpoche talks about the five hindrances, rather than characterizing them as a problem or something to conquer or overcome, he refers to them as signs, indications of purification. These are not a problem. This is a good thing. This means your practice is working. You're doing it right. It's making a difference. And I think that that's a really, really important attitude to carry when you're doing this practice, because from my own experience, my time spent in Burma 30 something years ago, I beat myself up mercilessly, with these five hindrances. I shredded myself. So they're signs that our meditation is working. They're undermining, our practice is undermining our karmic imprints. And so the beauty is that when we persevere with these practices with some diligence, the paramita of joyful effort, right? You probably, if you've studied at all or had any learning of the paramitas, this diligence, this joyful effort is pretty important. And so slowly, slowly, our minds begin to settle. We become less distracted, less reactionary, less at the mercy of the stimulus or conditions in our environment. And our mind begins to experience more and more calm and peace. Wonderful. It might take a while, as we've said, but slowly, slowly, our mind becomes less restless, less turbulent, and more at ease. But the interesting thing is that this is not enough. It's great while it lasts to be able to practice and gain some calm, stability of mind. It's a reprieve from the vicissitudes of life, the ups and downs. It can be quite restorative in many ways to practice shamatha meditation. But it's really temporary. As soon as we get back out there in the world, all the craziness just comes back in. It does not irrevocably uproot our karmic patterns, if that makes sense. It just temporarily provides some relief from our distress. And so, in order to be liberated from our confusion, our karmic patterns, and our imprints, we need to access wisdom. We need to employ or engage in inquiry, what is called vipassana practice. So, as I said, beginning next week, we will get access to the Vipassana practices as outlined in each stage of stainless prajna. But it might be worth saying a little bit here about Vipassana. I won't say a lot because, as I said, I want to say that when you get, in the next month or two, when you get more exposure to the Vipassana practices, then I think when we talk about it, you will better understand how Vipassana actually works. But essentially, it begins by investigating the nature of our breath, right? So we've been working on the breath, we've used the breath. The breath is so critically connected to present moment experience and present moment place. And we've gone through this series of practices that keep getting deeper and deeper connected to our breath. But now we begin to investigate the nature of it. So we've gone from just settling in and establishing a stability, and now we have to turn on our inquiring mind and, say, what's going on here? And the beauty of that is that the shamatha, as I think I mentioned earlier, it gives stability to the mind, but it's kind of like it gives it kinetic energy, or it's like you put a dam in the river. It gives it power. It makes it more pliable. It makes it more flexible. It makes it more powerful in some way. So because the mind is no longer so all over the shop, it's not being distracted by things. It's not getting caught up in and reacting to what's going on. And because of that stability, that power that's acquired, then when we begin to investigate, the wisdom is much more accessible, if that makes sense. It's easier to see what's really going on. And so we need to turn on this inquiring mind, investigation, examination. We need to tap this flexibility, this power, this pliability, malleability of the mind to examine our experience and not just look at it, but also ask ourselves whether our perception or belief of how our experience is truly the way it is. So, you know, we begin to also examine our misperceptions that are imposed in our beliefs by virtue of our ignorance and confusion. And so we will systematically examine our misperceptions and closely examine the truth of our experience. And this is the way to, that's the thin end of the wedge that gives us access to wisdom, to insight, if that's the way of saying it. It's kind of like, this is where the purification works too, because there's this veil, confusion is, or delusion is often characterized as a veil. It's some smokescreen that exists between how I see things and how things truly are. And this examination, this investigation is really sort of working our way through the smokescreen or abating the smokescreen. I heard some teacher once, used the metaphor, it's like this veil, if you imagine it to be cloth, you know, some sort of linen or muslin or something. And each moment of awareness is like a pin we stick in the veil of confusion. And we, you know, after some time, this pin's going to start to have an impact on this veil. It's going to deteriorate this barrier that exists between how things are and how I actually mistakenly perceive things. And so over time, the veil, the confusion purifies or is mitigated, so to speak. And in that process, this is how wisdom, as I've characterized it before, is like a stealth practice. It kind of sneaks up from behind, and all of a sudden, understanding dawns in your mind, because as we know, the view is that wisdom is innate, it's inherent. And it, once we've taken away the confusion, once we've lifted the veil, then wisdom we will find. We'll say, those aha moments. Oh yeah, look at that. That's the way it is, right? That's how these practices work. And we get closer and closer and closer to seeing things as they truly are, and our understanding aligns with the true nature of reality, both on the relative and the absolute. That's essentially the way Vipassana works. And of course, in the ensuing months, we will have the opportunity to visit all these aspects of Vipassana, of insight. So at this point, once we've got our mind settled and we're calm and we turn on get out the flashlight, the torch to see things, our Vipassana journey has begun. And so these last two or three practices or sections in module three, particularly, well, it begins with investigating the nature of our breath in the fourth meditation, and then the meditation of closely considering, where we look at our breath or our experience through the lens of the five aggregates. We're back to the five aggregates, and then specifically in the meditation number six, the last one, the meditation on the impermanent nature of the breath. And that then is a launching pad. Those last three practices are essentially the beginning of Vipassana. We're no longer, you know, we have turned on the inquiring mind once we get to number four. And in the sessions that Kunsung and I are currently doing, next week we will deal with the settling of the breath number three, and the investigating the nature of the breath number four, and then in the third week we'll do number five, and then the last week we'll do number six. And so those of you who are participating, and I see a few faces who I saw yesterday, we'll get into specifically deepening our experience with the practices and what they mean, etc. So, I'm going to end it here. As I said, I don't want to get ahead of the program, but I suspect that possibly some of what I've said has caused you to question broader or yeah. So I'm happy to invite you to come on, unmute yourself or raise your hand and ask any questions, or if you wish, speak to your experience too, of having done these practices. I'm assuming now we're a few weeks into this module, and some of you may have participated in yesterday's sessions, that you're beginning to have, get more experience with these practices, and yeah, so may be able to speak more to your experience of what's going on. But I see a couple of hands are raised. So, Annie, over to you. Unmute yourself. Nice to see you.
Hi, nice to see you too again. I have a question, and I maybe it's a contrarian attitude of mine, but in which I can't help. But in dukkha and suffering, and that life is suffering, and it's what is the word you said? Unsatisfactory, all of that. But in Mingyur Rinpoche's book, In Love with the World. You know, there isn't there a way to live in the world and not have these afflictions and not have and not have the aversion and the clinging and the ignorance and have and see it clearly and not have suffering? Isn't that possible?
Absolutely, that's the goal. That's the third noble truth.
Thought so. Yeah, that would be really nice. Okay.
Yeah, the problem is we've got to get there.
Well, it's a good
Yes,
nice journey. It's
it is.
worthwhile.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm being a little flippant. And actually the last module, Module 9, I think it is, that we won't get to until June, July sometime of this year, really gets much more into the fruit of the path,
Great.
from this tradition specifically. Which, of course, here we're talking about Abhidhamma practices, which is early Buddhism, where the goal is arahatship. Which is distinct from the Mahayana path, where the goal is Bodhisattva path or Buddhahood as the goal, and so there is some differences in the ways in which the fruit of the path is articulated or outlined, but in either case or all cases. There is, Rinpoche talks about, even in the path of liberation, this prospect of direct realization, this prospect of being able to have a direct experience of the unconditioned or nirvana, however you want to understand it. And it's described in the various traditions very, very similarly. As a few mind moments where one or a collection of those mind moments are unconditioned, and in that process, a portion or some of the kleshas are uprooted, and it's irrevocable. Yes, so in the Hinayana or Abhidhamma tradition, they talk about stream entry. Similarly, in the Theravada tradition, and then in the Mahayana tradition, they talk about a direct realization or the first bhumi of the 10 bhumis of the way of the Bodhisattva. But the various ways these experiences are characterized, it's an event that occurs in your mind based on the practices that are laid out, in the Abhidhamma, in this path, or in the Mahayana or the Vajrayana. There is a moment where we have a direct experience of the unconditioned nirvana, and in that, then what happens after, then we are irrevocably transformed. Our mind stream, our karmic imprints are radically modified. We still have kleshas. We still got a long way to go, whichever path we're on. If it's the Hinayana path, stream entry is the first of four stages. If it's the Mahayana path, the first bhumi is the first of 10 phases that lead to Buddhahood. So there's still a lot of work to do, but we're guaranteed, we can never go, we have put one foot out of samsara. Yeah, we
A
will.
guarantee.
Yes, guaranteed. It's a sure bet from here on in, and it may, it may take a few more lives. It's possible to progress further in this life, but it's really, and both my Burmese teacher Chamyesa Adorje and Mingo Rinpoche, particularly in the, in the higher levels of the path of liberation or advanced nature of mind teachings, frequently encouraged one to strive towards this direct moment, this moment of direct seeing, this moment of direct realization, sometimes referred to as opening the eye of wisdom. And
Interesting.
yeah, there's this, there, there's this, yeah, because one sees directly the unconditioned. And all doubt disappears. You have no doubt after that. You have a firm conviction that the Dharma is the path and will lead to your liberation. Some of the kleshas, particularly of greed and aversion, will be mitigated, but we're still not free. Yeah.
May I ask another question?
Sure.
What if so? At some point, you the Hinayana path, or the Mahayana path. I mean, do you choose and go, okay, I'm going. I mean, I'm not sure
Well,
how
you
you
could.
make that, how that happens.
You
Is it your
definitely could.
aspiration?
Yes. Yes, you definitely could choose.
Okay.
And
Is your aspiration?
some years ago I started a master's degree in Buddhist studies, and I did never finish my thesis because Mingo Rinpoche asked me to come, and we set up Turgar in 2009, and I just got too much for me to hit the books. But I've written about a quarter of a thesis that was about that very point. What is the distinguishing difference between the why? Because when I read the literature in both traditions, the Mahayana and the Theravada tradition, the actual definition or description of what happens in the mind at the moment of seeing was, for all intents and purposes, identical. Minor differences, somewhat, maybe. And I thought, well, why does one lead to Arhat and the other lead to Buddhahood? And motivation was where I landed, and particularly bodhicitta. It's bodhicitta, and that's why bodhicitta is such a important integral path of the Mahayana Vajrayana path. In order to bring all beings to the state of omniscient Buddhahood, I will practice the path. Or may the merit of my generosity and other virtuous deeds lead to Buddhahood for all people. So it's like, it's my actions, it's everything I do. It's the driving force of mind, body, and speech that is engaged in activity will lead to my awakening, so that I may be of benefit to all beings. That's bodhicitta. And that makes the difference as to whether I become a Buddha or an Arhat.
So, if you don't have an aspiration to benefit all beings, and you continue to do the practice, and should you achieve your goals, you would be arahat. Is that what
Yes.
you're saying? So it's the
Yes.
aspiration. Okay, thank you.
Yes. Yes. And so it's said, and I've heard Mingo Rinpoche say this, that bodhicitta is the cause of Buddhahood. Yeah, that's a critical, in the t sense of causality, in relative reality, bodhicitta in relative reality, body, speech, and mind, here in this giant causal matrix we call samsara, Bodhicitta is what will give right, make it possible for us to become Buddhas, or to realize our true nature. We already are Buddhas, we're just a little confused.
Thank
But
you
thanks,
very
eh?
much.
Yeah, you're welcome. So Tara, yeah, you've got your hand up. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. So at the beginning of your talk tonight, you were talking about, subject and object. And I've always been confused by this whole idea of non-dualism and, the selfless thing. So I understand that, things are empty, and which means that they're empty of inherent existence and all that. But it's like, but then I've heard other teachers say, well, things exist, they just don't exist in the way that you think they do. So, when you say there's no self, what exactly does that mean?
I don't think it's accurate to say there is no self. I think it's more accurate to say what we experience is not self. We mistakenly, I believe it to be the self, but it's actually non-self or not self, rather than it actually being self. But there's no question that while ever we are in this body and have a conscious mind, we will have a sense of being.
Yeah, that there's something that exists
Yes.
that is
Well,
my
we'll have a.
body and my mind.
Yes. And so I think also, and I, if you were on the program I did yesterday at some point, I talked or spoke to this notion of relative and absolute, which is a critical part of. I mean, Rinpoche talks about it somewhere. I think we had a session, I think, where he talked about relative and absolute. And it's a critical understanding within Buddhist teachings. But there is another wonderful teachings that I've heard Mingyur Rinpoche give many times, and I've also read other teachers' treatise on this teaching. This notion that the nature of our mind is luminous, clarity, awareness, cognizance. I like that word. You've heard me use that word, cognizance, the capacity to know. If the mind wasn't clear, radiant, aware, we'd have no experience. What would happen? Right? Everything you experience is because the mind knows. And so the way Rinpoche talks about it is this clarity, this knowing quality of the mind has self-luminosity and other luminosity. And he uses that example of if you light a candle in a dark room, you can see, depending on how bright it is, you can see objects around. That's the other luminous aspect of the mind. But you don't need a torch or a flashlight to see that the candle is also a light. And that's the self-luminous nature of the mind. And so when we sit here in our experience, if we do open awareness, or if you've been practicing path liberation and you've been introduced to the nature of your mind, you have some sense of this subjectivity, this knowing, right? That's the self-luminous aspect of the mind. And you also have some sense of objects that appear within your knowing. That's the other luminous aspect of the mind. The primordial confusion, ignorance that's got us in samsara in the first place is that we have mistaken the luminosity of our mind. We have split it, bifurcated it, made it dual into subject and object. And this is our, it isn't this way. This is a mistake and this is a misperception that there is something out there and something in here. It's just the manifestation of the luminous nature of our mind. And if we can rest in the union of that luminosity and emptiness, then the kleshas won't exist. There'll be no, we will, all of what drives us to chase after objects or push away objects is dissipated. The karmic imprints are liberated as they arise, while ever we can rest in that understanding. And that, in essence, is the core of the teachings that are in the Path of Liberation.
But they're not saying that those things don't exist, right?
Of course, it's relative
Yeah.
reality here in reality.
Right.
You know, when you step off the curb, knowing that that's a bus that's coming is a very good thing.
Yes.
Otherwise,
Okay.
right? And so here again, knowing the laws of relative reality, which is causal, right? And that's what we're looking at here in this Abhidhamma teachings, how our sense doors receive sense impressions, and how the you know they fall into these categories of the five aggregates. And our problem is that we think it's me. And it's the seeing the not self, you know, anicca anatman in Sanskrit. It's that is the wisdom. That and only when you and so that's why this moment of seeing direct a realization is so critically important, because until you get a taste, a flavor of the unconditioned, you will not understand this notion of not self. You will, until you've seen, had a glimpse of the ultimate reality, you won't understand how all of that pervades this conditioned reality too. And you know, if you're practicing Path Liberation, this supplication to the Dakpo Kogyu says, "May I realize the inseparability of samsara and nirvana." Yeah, and you know, I think this is a really important thing to bring to your practice and to understand. Boy, look, time's getting away, and I see Bruce's. But anyway, thanks for the question, Tara. Bruce, how are you?
Good, good. Yeah, I understood what you said tonight. But just you talk about arahats, I
Yeah.
think, and the Buddhism, the difference of. I didn't know what that was, and I'm assuming an arahat will leave the world and go up into live in a cave or something, where a Buddha will go into the world, or what is it?
Yeah, so essentially the understanding within the early Buddhist teachings, what's in the Abhidhamma, Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma, Theravadana school of thought, is that the goal is to become an arahat, which is one who has completely eliminated all the kleshas, all the karmic, purified one's karmic imprints. It may result in access to clairvoyance or supernatural powers of some sort, but it will not be accompanied by the motivation to stay in samsara for the benefit of all beings. It's like we're liberated. It's still enlightenment, but it doesn't include this motivation to be a benefit to others.
To be a benefit to others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's what I thought.
Yeah, thanks. And Diane, I think we've got time. We've got 5 minutes left. Nice to see you. How are you? There you go.
Hi,
You're
good. Thank
unmuted.
you. Yeah, thank you. My question is short. I'm just continuing on what Annie was saying about choosing, or, well, my question is it important to choose on the way to liberation if you want to get rid of your kleshas and karmic winds and whatever and practice? Is it important to choose one vehicle, like to study Hinayana and practice Hinayana, and that's it, and that's what I'm doing? Or to decide to follow the Mahayana path. Because, as far as I'm concerned, I've had bits and pieces of different
Right.
ones. First, I was introduced to Mahayana, then a bit of Hinayana, and I'm sort of continuing like this. But do you think it's important at a certain point to choose one path, one vehicle? Are there some advantages to do that? Should we
Yeah.
do that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can only relay what I've heard Mingo
Yeah.
Rinpoche say, which is in the Vajrayana vehicle, we practice all three vehicles on the same cushion at once. So there's a way as your practice progresses and as your understanding evolves through study and books and programs like this, etc., that there are elements of Hinayana understanding practice that are relevant in everyday life, particularly when dealing with the challenges and difficulties of samsara. And there are practices in the Mahayana, particularly the wisdom of emptiness and so forth, and and the third turning of the wheel, which gets even transformed in practices in the Vajrayana. But there's ways in which you then, if you have all three jhanas, if you understand, have practices, and access to understanding from all three vehicles, then at any given time you've got different ways to relate to your challenges, to your difficulties. Understanding that the Hinayana and the Mahayana is what is understood as a causal vehicle, so you're really working with the causes of samsara and the purification of the ignorance that is the cause of samsara. And in the Vajrayana vehicle, we're practicing the fruitional vehicle or the resultant vehicle, where we're taking the fruit, Buddhahood, as the path. And so all three are perfectly fine.
There is sort of an idea of continuum, isn't
Absolutely, yes. And
there?
so I don't really think it's not a zero, it's not an either or a right or
Okay,
wrong,
good. How
or a
good.
better or worse. I don't think that's the right way to understand it. It's like sometimes if you want to dig a hole, sometimes you need a shovel, sometimes you need a crowbar, sometimes you need a pickaxe.
Yeah.
It's all.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes,
Well, I'm comfortable like this, so if it's
yeah,
great.
and then of course the Mahayana vehicle is such an emphasis on bodhicitta,
Yeah.
and it's really interesting, I think, that when you really kind of get a deeper sense of bodhicitta and Buddha nature, there's a way in which your practice might feel like something's missing. It's kind
Yeah.
of not, there's something incredibly motivational, incredibly purposeful about bodhicitta and guru yoga, Buddha nature in some level. So anyway,
Thank you.
It's understood, intended that all practices would occur on the one cushion at the same time.
Great.
Well, look at this. It's top of the hour. We wasted, as they say on Car Talk, we've wasted another perfectly good hour. So anyway, it's been delightful, wonderful to have you here again. I hope what we're the we're, yeah we had fun, and I hope it's been a benefit. But we should just close with a little moment of practice and dedication. So if you could find your meditation posture again. And just again connect to present moment experience. And given that we're doing these wonderful practices of shamatha, let's bring your attention to your breath. You don't necessarily have to count or follow, whatever works in terms of connecting. Resting this knowing quality of the mind with this incredibly critical, important body function of breathing. As the Buddha said, when breathing in, know that you are breathing in. When breathing out, know that you are breathing out. And taking a moment to reflect on our time together here today, exploring these remarkable teachings, the Dhamma, that articulate the path so that we might be free from suffering. And may whatever benefit has occurred from our time together, let's dedicate it to the welfare and happiness of all beings. Wherever they might be, may they quickly realize the nature of their mind. Thank you, everyone. See you next time. Have fun.
Thank you, Edward.
Yeah, bye. All of us.
Good night. Or
good night.
Thank you, everyone.
Good night, bye good bye. Day, good morning, good whatever. May it be good, whatever
thank
it
you.
Is.
Bye.
Bye.